Kia ora koutou. Welcome to the New Zealand General Practice Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Scott Jones. Earlier seasons of this podcast focused on joint practice. This season is an opportunity to listen in on monthly conversations I have with Dr. Dave Mapleston, organised for the Pinnacle GP Network. Dave shares insights into important clinical changes he picks up in his reading as a part-time GP and advisor to the Health and Disability Commissioner. I hope you enjoy.
Morena tato. Yep, I'm Dave Mapleston. I'm part-time GP, very much part-time GP, which means I do have time to read some of the huge screeds of stuff that come over our email and post, etc., on a whole variety of things. So for September, I've stuck together a few bits and pieces, some quite practical, some sort of preempting the learned patients coming in and requesting things.
Nice.
Which leads me to number one, which is I want a blood test for cancer.
Yes.
So we do hear that from time to time. I want my complete physical, etc. But this actually has some basis. So on a recent Medscape article reported on the Galeri test, which is available in the USA, and the blood test returns one of two possible results, either a positive cancer signal detected, plus a list of the top predicted cancer signal origins, or negative, no cancer signal detected. And the manufacturer claims that when a cancer signal is detected, the test predicts the origin of the cancer signal with high accuracy, which might help guide the steps to diagnosis. And currently, more than 50 types of cancer can be detected with this test. It sounds a little bit pie in the sky, but the what the test does is detect abnormalities in the methylation patterns of cell-free DNA that could indicate the presence of cancer using quite high-tech next-generation sequencing and machine learning algorithms. So when the cancer signal is detected, the test identifies the origin of the signal with high accuracy. So the website, which I've put links to, has quite a lot of, looks like reasonably robust trials and evidence. So it's got a specificity of 99.5%, so a false positive rate of 0.5%, meaning in roughly 200 people tested without cancer, only one person received a false positive result, i.e. cancer signal detected. And the overall sensitivity of the test for any stage of cancer was 51.5%, although it was higher for later stage cancers, about 77% for stage 3, and 90% for stage 4, although of course, by the time you're stage 4, you've generally got other indications that you've got something going on, but lower for early stage cancers. So only 16.8% for stage 1 and 40.4% for stage 2. So what sounds quite promising for starters, but when you start to think, well, you know, what we're aiming for is detection at an early treatable stage, it starts to look far less impressive. But there are multiple ongoing studies going on, including an NHS trial in the UK attempting to validate the preliminary results. And the cost of the test is around $950, which, given the state of the New Zealand and US dollars today, is fairly expensive. So I guess what to think about is if a patient comes in saying, well, look, I'm prepared to spend $2,000 on this test, what will it do for me? I guess the answer really is that if you've got no suspicion, no indication that you're likely to have cancer, you're fit and well, it's not going to be actually that specific, that sensitive for diagnosing very early cancer. And you know, in fact, I probably wouldn't spend $2,000 on a test that has a sensitivity of 16.8% for stage one cancers. If you're older, I mean, yeah, if you're as old as me, well, maybe you would consider it because your risks are going up with age. But the technology I found quite fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. My initial response is the same as to those investment people that ring you up and tell you that none of their investments have knowingly gone down or 20% return on your investment, and you sort of think, well, yeah, sounds far too good to be true.
And we all know about that. If it sounds far too good to be true, it likely is.
But you know, if I was a 59-year-old. Man, and I did this test and it was negative. Yeah, it's not really giving me any information, but if it's positive, I know that there's something going on. But it could be one of 50 different things and it could be at any sort of stage. So I'm then going to be left with a range of investigations going on that, you know, may or may not show anything.
That's right. I mean, I think the results that you get do list in order of likelihood, the sites that they've identified with the markers, but you might have five different sites.
Yeah.
So I guess that could narrow down the, you know, which bit of you to image or whatever. But essentially, yeah, I think it's interesting technology, but probably not refined enough at the moment to be practically useful.
But obviously refined enough for them to be able to sell it in America.
Absolutely, at a reasonable price. So that's just really preempting the patient inquiry. Those ones that
nice
that, watch catch up and on
and watch this space. You know, as you say, it's these are the sort of the nirvanas, aren't they? If you can, I'm really interested in a specific prostate cancer test. If you get something that actually really can tell you whether this is a significant prostate cancer or one that you can just, you know, ignore, that's another nirvana.
And that will lead us later on to a discussion on looking at results of PSA.
So okay.
We'll slip to a more practical topic, which is recurrent UTI in women mainly. And there have been a couple of publications come out recently, one Tools for Practice and one article in New Zealand Doctor looking at the evidence for efficacy of antibiotic prophylaxis for recurrent UTI in non-pregnant women. Recurrent UTI was defined as greater than or equal to 3 episodes in 12 months or 2 in 6 months. And the conclusion with antibiotic prophylaxis does decrease the risk of recurrent UTIs from 66% with placebo to 12% with prophylaxis over 6 to 12 months. There's some increase in adverse events with antibiotics, 15% versus 8% with placebo. But the NNT was 2 to 3, which is actually a pretty good standard of treatment. So long-term bacterial resistance and its individual clinical impact has not been well studied. That's the downside, I guess. And we've got to think about our antibiotic stewardship. With that, you're looking puzzled.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. I was there's a 12% of recurrence if you're taking the antibiotic prophylaxis over.
That's 60, right.
Versus 66% with placebo. Okay.
Definitely has an impact. So NNT of 2 to 3. No significant difference between nitrofurantoin and other antibiotics for UTI reduction, but an increased risk of adverse events with nitrofurantoin around 1.8 times the average. And just again, a push with nitrofurantoin, there are rare cases of pulmonary toxicity noted with nitrofurantoin to watch for. And MedSafe have published on this previously. And note that in New Zealand, nitrofurantoin is contraindicated in patients with EGFR of less than 60.
Wow.
So I see it prescribed quite often in rest home patients whose EGFR is very often less than 60. And it relates to decreased efficacy and increased risk of peripheral neuropathy. But interestingly, the UK had revised this contraindication to less than 45, EGFR of less than 45 in 2014. And the contraindication in New Zealand is except on medical advice as a contraindication. So it looks as though there is a bit of leeway there in terms
so,
of.
So if somebody's been put on it and their renal function takes a plunge, which wouldn't be expected with that medication, but the a complaint is made, the response would be, well, it's the renal function's plunged, but not because of the nitrofurantoin tone. There was a risk putting it on because you were giving, the recommendation is less than 60 when you decided to do it with somebody whose EGFR was 35. How does that work?
I think if their EGFR was greater than 60 when you put them on, and that's fine. If their EGFR was 35 and you put them on, what you're more likely to see a complaint about is them getting a peripheral neuropathy because your risk is increased. That's why it's contraindicated in patients with reduced EGFR. Plus, it's not effective because it's mainly excreted in the kidney. That's where it works. So if it's not actually in there, it's less efficacious for UTI prevention. But I think the danger is if somebody complains because they became unwell, even if it was unrelated to the fact that they were prescribed nitrofurantoin with a reduced EGFR, there would have to be an observation that this was prescribed outside of recommendations, and unless there was a justification to do so and the patient was informed, there could be issues.
So I mean, the other thing that will happen if you're giving a medication that's got decreased efficacy and that doesn't work, you try again with higher doses, you try with longer courses, more likely to get side effects, more likely to end up being on prophylactic antibiotic, so that the harm that sort of comes from just that first decision could be quite significant.
Absolutely. And that's, again, why it's important, I think, particularly drugs we're prescribing reasonably frequently, to be really aware of the prescribing requirements. Mm. But the New Zealand Doctor article looks at other options for managing recurrent UTI, and certainly evidence that Hyprex, methenamine hipurate, is non-inferior to trimethoprim and possibly other antibiotics and a similar NNT for recurrent UTI, plus the use of vaginal estrogen therapy in postmenopausal women with recurrent UTI. Again, quite efficacious. The article also mentioned Urimmune, which is an unfunded immunostimulant against common urinary tract pathogens. And it's a series of drops taken sublingually for about 3 months. Costs around $340 per course, and a systematic review that's linked on the page showed quite a wide range of 12-month UTI free rates, varying between 36% and 90%. So I don't know which side you choose, but possibly quite efficacious, and so it's an immune stimulant rather than a drug or antibiotic or antiseptic agent per se. I've checked it. I couldn't find anywhere in New Zealand that you could get it online or import it, but it seems to be available through some private urology clinics who advertise it. The urologists advertise it, they're interestingly. And the other thing that's used from time to time is D-mannos, which is available over the counter. And that has a weak evidence base for efficacy, but insufficient to recommend it routinely. Main adverse effect of that was mild diarrhea and bloating.
Why does my head go into my hands when I hear the term immune stimulant?
Yes. Well, I think because we hear it so often with these things being advertised on TV, and I listen to these ads for the natural products. So every ad has natural and support in it.
Yes.
You'll never hear it without support for your bones, support for your immune system, support for your prostate, support for your goodness knows what, all natural. I'm not sure how natural the Urimmune is, but I'm sure it'll be in there somewhere.
Okay. Thank you for bringing that to our attention.
So if you've prescribed your nitrofurantoin inappropriately and the patient has died, we move on to the next step, which is viewing the body. So a recent edition of GP Pulse raised the issue of whether a video link could be considered an adequate examination prior to completing a cremation certificate, particularly if there was a risk of COVID-19. And the Ministry of Health have noted a change or an exemption from one of the cremation regulations as part of the COVID framework. So essentially, if you are the deceased patient's doctor and you're happy to write a death certificate, obviously, if it's not for cremation, there's no need to see or examine the patient after death. But if it is for cremation, normally you'd be required to physically see and identify the body and certify whether there's a pacemaker implanted. So under the COVID framework, there was an exemption to Section 7, which is that section. So if the patient's died from COVID-19 and they live in a rest home, residential care facility, or other long-term inpatient facility, you may be exempt from actually viewing the body. So in that case, the undertaker identifies whether there's an implanted pacemaker. What you need to do is, under this authorization, a medical referee must receive advice from a trusted source who has a reasonable level of assurance of the cause of death to verify the identity of the deceased and that the deceased died of natural causes. So I presume in a long-term aged care facility, that might be a nurse who's been nursing the patient. Not a nurse practitioner, but one of the staff nurses who knows the patient, can identify the patient, can identify after discussion with you the likely cause of death, which fits in with the scenario, and then provides a statement to the medical referee in lieu of the cremation certificate. But there is a third situation where the body must be physically seen and examined, and that's when you're certifying death, where you weren't involved in the person's care, but you're acting on behalf of the normal attending clinician. But again, if it's the COVID type situation, this advice from a trusted source clause may well apply. Essentially, what I'd say is, look, if it is a situation where you think that you might be at risk of either bringing COVID into the facility or getting COVID yourself by going in to view this body, or even if you view the body at the mortuary, check the regulations and see if it is a situation where you can be exempted from this Section 7 of the cremation requirements.
Yeah. It's something that I know is under review, and there's discussions going on around changes to the Burials and Cremations Act currently, and I'm sure this will be on the agenda. But it's great to have that clarity around this, because there's been a lot of confusion about whether or not, particularly for the cremation form, whether viewing the body by a video link is acceptable or not. And what you're telling us there is it's very clear that unless it's those specific situations for COVID in a rest home or other long-term patient facility, that it isn't acceptable to view a body for cremation by video link.
And certainly this doesn't apply to a patient dying at home. It's only patients in long-term inpatient facilities, rest home, residential care. It doesn't apply to hospice or hospitals or home.
Yeah, and again, only when they've died from COVID-19. Which is thankfully reducing.
I keep fingers crossed. It might be the famous last words.
But again, I think it's worth noting, it's something that is being discussed, because it's there are circumstances where I could see it being quite acceptable and reasonable, particularly in a resource poor environment, for a video examination to be reasonable. But I know that the edges of that, the implications of it, need to be really carefully sort of thought through. And I gather there are conversations happening around that.
Yeah, just I guess there need to be standards around.
Yeah.
Do you view the whole body, the face, the scene of the death or whatever?
Yeah.
So number four, just this is what I've called the case of the month, and what I might do is try and incorporate a complaint of interest that I've reviewed in one of my other jobs for discussion. So this is a case I've seen recently where a patient had a radical prostatectomy for prostate cancer, was discharged back to the general practice after a couple of follow-ups with the urologist. The discharge leader gave explicit advice that the patient was to have six monthly PSAs for 2 years and then annual PSA. And if the PSA ever became detectable, he was to be referred back for consideration of salvage radiotherapy while it was still confined to the prostate area, presumably.
Yeah. Not an uncommon sort of...
No, these days, I think we'll see that from time to time. So that letter was acknowledged. The patient was coded as having had prostate cancer and radical prostatectomy and was put on the recall for the PSAs. Initially for the six monthly PSAs. So these PSAs were received. The first one was undetectable. The second one after a year first one at 6 months was undetectable. Next one was about 0.1. Next one was 1.2, et cetera, et cetera. And it was only 3 years later when he got a level back at 4.7 that he was actually then, it was recognised that these results, previous results, which had all been looked at by different practitioners and ticked off as normal because they were within the reference range for a normal situation. It was only when it became outside the reference range of normal that it was recognised he needed referral, but this was now 3.5 years down the track. So and by that stage, he actually had metastatic prostate cancer and there was no chance of salvage radiotherapy. So it was so easy to see how this could happen because this is a practice that has a reasonable turnover of staff covering each other, a team approach, which we all try and do on looking at the whole situation. How could this have been avoided? And I think the sorts of things that we've looked at are putting in a patient alert or ensuring that the disease classification really absolutely clarifies a need for extraordinary or some sort of different monitoring. The issue with that is alert fatigue, which is a recognized phenomenon, and there's been quite a lot of stuff in the medical literature about it. Mm. And I'm sure we all recognize that when MIMS pops up, you know, your topical steroid might interact with your whatever. So that I think is only partially effective. What if all PSA results were to be reviewed by the patient's usual GP? Is that going to change the issue? So that would involve, you know, an in-house change in your management of results, or if your nurses are looking at normal results and just flicking you the so-called abnormal ones, would they flick you all PSAs, for example?
And increasingly, it's a team approach.
As it should be, I think, or as we need it to be. So, and I think one of the things that we don't do exceptionally well is greater involvement of the patient. So in this case, if there'd been discussion from the outset of what the test results mean and what would be abnormal in his specific situation, and he had access to his own results via the patient portal rather than ringing and having the nurse say, look, it's all normal, it may well be he, you know, taking some responsibility for his own health, recognises, well, you know, there's a discrepancy here and questions it, and the issue is brought up or acknowledged a lot faster.
It's got to be part of the, if you do a test, people need to understand why they're having the test done.
Yep.
But, you know, obviously that's can't be the whole picture. It's not the patient's responsibility to understand the implications of the test fully. But they do have to be part of the team.
Yeah, absolutely. Just that partnership, that whole partnership with the patient as well as with other members of your team. And I was trying to think of other situations where this could occur. And one of them would be, I guess you've got somebody with GI symptoms, not quite sure about, you know, how significant they are, and a drop in hemoglobin over 6 months from, say, 148 to 128 might be quite significant. But in fact, if you're just looking at the results in isolation, they're both within the normal range and might not actually trigger any sort of question. So how do you sort those results out, which you might want to be seeing rather than your practice nurse or whoever's covering the results for you that flicks them off as normal?
Yeah. I wonder if the rise of the potential, this clinical assistant role where we're creating a protocol around somebody looking at the inbox messages and what they mean. So as you say, you can protocolize when somebody has a PSA, these are the actions that are taken, that might start to create another sort of set of standards around how these things can or should be managed across a wider range of practices. Obviously, it's at a stage at the moment where those protocols are being developed. Clinical assistants are working in a number of practices under those protocols which have been agreed. But, you know, as the as that becomes more normal practice, that might actually sort of strengthen our management of these inbox messages in a way. You know, when you do that HbA1c, as you're talking about, if this can be managed by a clinical assistant, that needs to be signed off by the person who's ordered the test to say, and if this is normal, you can file it and tell the patient. If it's not, it means the person ordering the test makes it very clear why the test has been done and what the actions need to be taken about the result.
Yes.
I think a problem there, as you've said, HbA1c, you've got this GI issue. We want you to do a test every month for the next 6 months to see if there's a drop in hemoglobin, and then you go off and, you know, start working somewhere else. And that plan is never really articulated somewhere.
And it comes back, I think, in some ways to what is practical versus what is ideal. So ideal is that the clinic, whoever's reviewing the notes, whoever's reviewing the result, will look at the notes and then get the context. But of course, it doesn't happen. There's not the time to look into the notes. But it's similar when you're doing repeat scripts for somebody else. Theoretically, you should be checking the notes to make sure that this is appropriate for this patient, because you're putting your name on the line.
Absolutely. I'm doing a lot of virtual sort of review of inboxes and repeat prescriptions and so on in my role at the moment. And it's pretty easy in the practice management system to look at the trend line of a result. You know, it's another click that you have to do. But just to say, asking yourself, well, why was this test done? I know it's normal, but why was it done? And usually you can pick it up from, okay, they've had a renal function test because they're on an ACE inhibitor and they had a repeat prescription done. You know, if it's a PSA, I always want to know why it was done and when the last done, what the trend was. And if there isn't a detail in the classifications about why somebody's having regular PSAs, then I will put it in, and I'll put in an action plan in there as well to say, so that next time I'm looking at it, I can say, okay, well, if it becomes detectable, it needs to be referred. Or if it gets above, sometimes the urologist has said, if it's above 12 refer, or if it's above 20 refer, you know, those things seem to be quite personalized to the patient and the urologist, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Increasingly remembering that the clinical notes are just not an aid memoir for one person. They're a vital source of information for the whole team. Anyone that's looking at these notes or doing any action on behalf of the patient.
Yeah. I haven't really thought about what the patient can see through their portal as well, because you could, I know that for myself, I can see what my results are, but I don't know that there's anywhere where it tells me what to do if my results are abnormal, you know, or, you know, what my results might mean. You could message the patient so that they know if your PSA becomes detectable, you need to discuss that with the clinician. And that was visible in the portal. When I looked at my result, I might be able to see and be reminded about that, again, just as part of that safety netting.
I can't remember whether if you make a comment on the result, whether that shows in the portal.
Yes, it does.
Right. Yeah. So if you're putting normal, it depends how well the patient has been educated as to whether they would disagree with this, your perception of the result being normal, despite the fact that you had this discussion at the outset, which was if it became detectable, it needed action. So there's not going to be a perfect system. I think it's going to end up being a number of things that we try and, you know, try and set these safety measures in place so that if one fails, there is one, a next one that can be relied upon.
Yeah. I talk about set piece conversations, in a sports game, there's going to be a throw in, there's going to be a penalty corner and the team prepares for those set piece events. Practices know that there are going to be PSA results that are coming through, and they know that they're going to be viewed by a range of different people, probably within any one team. Having a set piece conversation as a team about, okay, how are we managing our inboxes, but let's have a set piece conversation about what happens with PSAs and where do we record, so that if I'm looking at your inbox, I know why that PSA was done and what to do with it if it's abnormal. Mm-hmm. And you know, creating that the culture of a team approach to the way that we manage things, I think could be quite useful as a result of this.
Absolutely. But certainly one just worth looking at. And again, if within a practice you do have any near misses, absolutely important to bring it up in the team situation to acknowledge a near miss, but and then work out how a situation could be avoided in the future.
Yeah, and I'm sure that your PHO medical director or others would be really keen to hear of those things so that we can share the learnings about that as well. So, you know, do consider that. Don't send them all to me specifically, but if you're listening to this from the other side of the world or the other side of New Zealand, if you're a pedicle GP, then certainly feel free to let me know about the near misses and so that we can collectively learn from them.
Just to polish off our three quickies, called them. So one, I'm fascinated with calculators. So I love objective things. Mm-hmm. And just a reminder, a lot of you probably know, but the FIB4 calculator, which uses the patient's age, platelet level, AST and ALT levels to determine the likelihood and degree of liver fibrosis, mainly in patients with conditions such as chronic hepatitis, alcoholic liver disease, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and cholestatic and metabolic liver diseases. So it's used in the referred to in the health pathways under non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. That the pathway suggests calculating the FIB4 score to determine the stage of the disease, and they give you advice if it's over a certain level to refer for a fibro scan. And it can also be used to monitor worsening of fibrosis in patients as well. Just also a plug at the same time for the health pathways liver function.
Yes.
Pathway. It's just so, I mean, we always get these annoying little elevations of AST or ALT or GGT by itself, whatever. And what do you do with them? And this just gives you a nice, clear, and succinct pathway to follow when you should be concerned, when you might be considering an ultrasound, etc.
Yeah, I found that really useful. Again, managing inboxes, actually, you know, you look at these slightly abnormal liver function tests, and I'm looking at colleagues who've decided to, you know, follow them up and do all sorts of other tests. And I'm thinking, gosh, I wouldn't have decided to do that. And so actually, even something as common as a liver function test, going back to the health pathways, was very reassuring, really. And I can understand why my colleagues are making those decisions, but it was reassuring for me to find that I was working within the recommended guidelines. So that was and it would have been a learning curve had I not been. So you know, that was really good. I think the other thing, just the first page that you were looking at there, was not localized to our region. And I think the message there is, don't worry if you see that in the community health pathways. If the page isn't adapted for your region yet, that doesn't mean to say that the clinical information in there is not relevant or out of date. Often it means that the advice around how to go about making the referral or the request for further investigation is going to be different in your region than it is for the people that wrote the original health pathway. So the clinical content, I think, is a really good guide. But don't ignore pages that just haven't been adapted yet.
I think there's no major physiological differences between Christchurch inhabitants and Hamilton inhabitants as a rule.
Maybe the cheese rolls might make a difference. I don't know.
So second to last, or third to last, sorry, prescriber update very recently, just reminding us that NSAIDs are contraindicated in the third trimester of pregnancy. Mm-hmm. Mainly for or both maternal and fetal effects. Maternal effects, prolonged labour and increased risk of postpartum hemorrhage. Fetal effects, premature closure of ductus arteriosus, fetal renal impairment and oligohydramnios. And neonatal effects of respiratory distress syndrome, persistent pulmonary hypertension of the newborn, bronchopulmonary dysplasia, renal failure, IV hemorrhage and necrotizing enterocolitis. So contraindicated in the third trimester, and shouldn't be used during the first two trimesters of pregnancy unless the expected benefits to the mother outweigh the risks to the fetus. I'm not sure how many pharmacists query women on their pregnancy status when they go and buy their OTC, Voltaren or Nurofen, but they certainly should be looking at the potential effects.
You just buy it in the supermarket. You don't need...
Yeah. Well, that's right. Yeah. So there's a risk there. But as long as you're not the one doing the damage, I think that's important.
Well, I think the other message that we can take from that is to remind people when they're pregnant that they need to take what they're putting into their body seriously, and that arranges medications as well as food, and you know, to always think about it if in whatever stage of pregnancy. There's no harm asking a question, is there?
And I've certainly had patients that equate paracetamol with Nurofen because they sit beside each other, and as you say, in the supermarket shelf.
Yeah.
And why would they think there's any difference between them? Just on the prescribing line, there's been a change due to supply issues in the liquid brands of paracetamol. So the Avalon brand is going to be used until a new standard subsidized brand is available, which will be a few months. And the key differences with the current Paracare are that the flavor for both strengths of the syrup is strawberry vanilla. So previously there was a difference between the two strengths, orange for one and strawberry for the other. So these two strengths look the same, taste the same. They're both off-white color. The stronger preparation is 240 milligrams per 5 mils rather than 250 milligrams per 5 mils. So again, you might have to adjust the dosage recommendation for patients who've been used to the 250 and 5. And there are patient education leaflets available in a variety of languages, which you can download from the Pharmac website.
Given that we've heard that paracetamol is just a placebo anyway, it doesn't really matter whether it's 250 or 240.
Well, you don't want to poison the patient with the placebo. That's the only thing.
Yeah, that's right. I'd say that tongue-in-cheek, so you know, absolutely. Question. It's certainly useful in irritated, feverish children, isn't it? And I like the idea of the strawberry and vanilla flavor as opposed to strawberry and orange, which is a bit weird. Like, you wouldn't normally have a strawberry and orange flavored.
Oh, no, one was strawberry and one was orange.
The
strong one was strawberry. The weak one was strawberry and the strong one was orange.
Yeah. And people always ask for the strawberry one.
Yeah, whereas both strengths of the new brand are the same taste. So, yeah. Whereas I think in the past that the patient sometimes identifies the strength. Oh, the orange ones for the older kids, the pink ones for the younger ones.
And
finally, just if you're needing to get someone into hospital or need to contact the registrar on call, there is an app which I think was pushed a bit during COVID, but I missed out on it. But and anyone else that might have missed out on it, the Am I On app, which is a link in the snippets. Which gives you, certainly for Waikato, gives you a list of all the on-call registrars and SMOs for the various specialties and times of the day and their mobile phone numbers.
Oh, yeah. Don't take any screenshots, everybody.
No. So this is today's one, this morning's one, Friday, September the 30th. So the access for Waikato is, access code is just Waikato. I'm not sure whether the other DHB areas have a similar, use the app similarly or give external access to it, but certainly for this area it could be helpful, particularly if you're being held up on the switchboard or can't get through the switchboard. And that is it for September.
Thank you, Dave. I think there are similar sorts of things for in other districts. I don't know that it's always the AMION app, but it's certainly hopefully as we move into the new health reforms, those sorts of things will become more consistent across the country. Thanks, Dave. Absolutely brilliant. We talked about the blood test for cancer, recurrent UTIs, and just again that reminder about renal function, I suppose. The viewing of the body, slightly disappointing that we don't have that flexibility, but you know, there's more information to come. I'd really encourage people to do those set piece conversations around, particularly around maybe something like PSA in a practice, to sort of explore how you're doing things as a team. And then you gave me three little quickies at the end, the fibrous scan, fib for calculating, the reminder about non-steroidals in the third trimester of pregnancy, but really throughout pregnancy, the paracetamol thing. So yeah, now that's absolutely awesome, Dave. Thank you. We'll see you again next month.
My pleasure. Kia ora.
Thanks for listening. Please like and share this podcast if you found it useful. The show notes on the podcast website contain links to all the resources that we discussed. A video version of this podcast is available on the Pinnacle Practice website at pinnacle.co.nz. Ka kite anō.